Well, I'd like to welcome everybody to our court this morning. We have lots of visitors. We also have many of our summer interns are going to be observing today, so we're happy to have them here at the court with us. We do have two cases on our morning docket. We will proceed directly through each of them. I am Justice Terry Livingston. To my right is Justice Leanne Dofino, and to my left is Justice Ann Gardner. And we're happy to hear y'all's arguments today. The first case is McDowell versus McDowell and CMP. It's cause number 2-16-38-CV. And I believe all the council have checked in already and given their estimated time for argument. Mr. Jay Beverly, I believe, is first.
Good morning.
What does the J stand for?
It's my name is Joe.
Joe, okay.
Yes, but my father was also Joe, so my parents have called me called me Jay from the beginning.
Oh, so you go by Jay?
Yes.
Well, good for you. All right.
Together with Roger Yale, we represent Cole McDowell in this case. And the primary issues in this case, I think, can be fit into something of a decision tree. The first issue would be, can a trial court enter a temporary injunction that freezes funds which are completely unrelated to any of the claims that are asserted in the lawsuit? That is, we have, in this case, as you're aware, we have a temporary injunction order which freezes funds which Mr. McDowell received from the settlement of his father's estate, which are completely unrelated to any of the claims asserted by his former wife. And I think that is undisputed. The answer there is clearly no. Then it shifts, and the question would be, if there is an allegation of a fraudulent transfer under the Texas Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, does that somehow allow this temporary injunction on completely unrelated assets? That is, does Texas Business and Commerce Code, specifically Section 24.008A3A, allow the court to freeze these unrelated assets? That is the interpretation of the other property language, which is in that particular statute. Again, we think the answer there is no, for two reasons here in this case. In this case, one specific reason was there was no evidence presented at the temporary injunction hearing that would actually allow the trial court to determine that there was a fraudulent transfer in this case. Otherwise, unless there is some proof, and of course on the temporary injunction hearing you don't have to establish your case completely, but there must be, under the correct standard of review, there must be some evidence tending to show that you have a probable right of recovery. In this case, we don't believe there was any evidence tending to show there was a probable right of recovery under the Fraudulent Transfer Act. So since the Fraudulent Transfer Act does not come into play, we would say no, under 24.008A3, that would not apply because there was no evidence sufficient to invoke the Fraudulent Transfer Act. Assuming the court disagreed on that, the next part of the decision tree would be, does the other property language in 24.008A3 allow a trial court to go after and freeze property that is unrelated to the claims of the lawsuit? There's very limited case law on what that actually means. How far that other property language extends in the statute. But our contention there, and I'll get into that a little more later, is that that would not comply with the principles of equity, and the statute specifically requires that any injunctive relief granted under the Fraudulent Transfer Act comply with the principles of equity. Then the final part of the decision tree, which may be dispositive, is did the temporary injunction comply with Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 683, and I think the answer there is clearly no. There was a complete failure to state why Mrs. McDowell and her limited partnership, CMP, would suffer irreparable harm if injunctive relief was not granted. There is only the most conclusory statement in the temporary injunction regarding that. So under Rule 6, I'll start with that argument. Under Rule 683, a temporary injunction is fatally flawed if the requirements of Rule 683 are not met. They are mandatory and must be followed. That's the InterFirst Bank San Felipe case, which we cite in our brief, 715 Southwest 2nd, 640 out of the Texas Supreme Court in 1986. So this has been the rule for quite a while. And the rule is also that even if the court believes that the evidence in the record supports the injunctive relief that is granted, if the temporary injunction order itself is not specific enough, if it does not have this nexus between the conduct and the harm, then it is fatal, and it is the temporary injunction order cannot stand. It must provide the reasons for believing that Mrs. McDowell and CMP had shown that they would suffer injury if injunctive relief was not granted. Here, the temporary injunction simply states, unless this order is entered, plaintiffs will suffer irreparable harm because there is no adequate remedy at law to grant plaintiffs complete, final, and equal relief. That type of language, that exact type of language, has been repeatedly rejected by courts of appeals. The main case we cite is In re Chalmette out of the First District Court of Appeals, 456 Southwest 3rd, 299. But it cites cases from Dallas, San Antonio, the other Court of Appeals in Houston, Waco, and this court, this court's case being the Bird Ranch case at 717 Southwest 2nd, 452, which basically follows the exact same language that is in the In re Chalmette case. And if there's any doubt about that, about how far this extends, you could look at, and I'm sure I'll butcher the names here, the El Tacaso v. Gire Star case, 356 Southwest 3rd, 740 out of Dallas. I think that's the best case, which demonstrates the strictness of this rule. There is a lot of detail in the trial court's injunction order, but when it gets down to the essence of it, it merely recites that the plaintiff has shown that it will suffer an irreparable injury, and the case and the Dallas Court of Appeals says the conclusory statement in that regard is simply not enough. So on the Rule 683 basis alone, the court could decide this case. I think there are other important issues in it with respect to the Fraudulent Transfer Act. And with respect to that, there were several paths, fraudulent transfer paths, alleged in the in plaintiff's petition.
Excuse me, I have a question.
Sure.
Before you get into your second discussion there, with respect to Rule 683, do any of those cases talk about whether there was a requirement to file a motion to modify the order or any kind of other preservation of error in the trial court, or was there?
I do not recall any of those cases specifically addressing that. It may be in there, but I, standing here today, I do not recall whether there anything. In this case, it's outside of the record, but I believe there was a later motion to modify, which was denied.
Okay.
Is my understanding. But that is outside of our record here. Moving on to the fraudulent transfer.
I'm sorry, how is it outside the record?
It's simply not in, it's not in the clerk's record, and it's not in the reporter's record at this, and the record has not been supplemented. I believe those have happened after the clerk's record and the reporter's record were filed in this court.
But they're part of this case or not?
Well, there's nothing in the record on appeal regarding what happened afterwards. We could supplement the record if the court would like us to do so.
But that could be important.
Okay.
I think we would.
All right. we will do that. With respect to the fraudulent transfer, this is an actual intent case, according to what the trial court's temporary injunction order states. There were other allegations regarding the antecedent debt or insolvency or not reasonably equivalent value aspects of the Fraudulent Transfer Act, but when you look at the temporary injunction order itself, it is based on actual intent. So with respect to looking at what evidence there was to support a claim for fraudulent transfer at the temporary injunction hearing, of course, there's almost never direct evidence of fraudulent intent. So you're going to go to look at the factors or so-called badges of fraud under 24.05B. But the actual evidence of any fraudulent transfers consisted of evidence regarding transfers that were made from two entities, Parker Properties 1100, and its general partner, SMMRAMJCM, which I'll refer to as SMM, if that's okay. There's evidence of transfers from those two entities. There's not any evidence of transfers from Safe Parking itself, which is one of the entities that is involved in the fraudulent transfer allegations. And there's very little evidence regarding any transfers made by Cole McDowell himself. So we have lots of evidence regarding transfers made by two other parties, which are not parties to the lawsuit, which are not targeted debtors, and there's no claim that either one of them made fraudulent transfers at this point. With respect to Cole McDowell himself, there's no evidence of transfers from him to insiders other than possibly his wife, Jamie McDowell. And those funds were, if you look at the evidence that is in the record under the exhibits, the evidence regarding Mr. McDowell's bank statements, most of the transfers look like ordinary expenses, things that you would expect someone to be paying, not fraudulent transfers. With respect to the other badges of fraud, the one I would like to talk about is concealment of transfer. That is 24.005B3. And Ms. McDowell claims that funds from the sale of 1100 Parker Square, which was the main asset that has been the subject of this dispute, were wrongfully dispersed because they weren't dispersed through a transfer agent. But that's no evidence that the sale was concealed or that the transfer was concealed. There are two cases which I believe we do cite in our brief but did not really discuss in much detail. One is Kaufman v. Morales, 93 Southwest 3rd, 650. That case says that the concealment badge of fraud requires a transfer to a third party, which I don't think we have here. Then there is another case, which we cite, NRA SMTC Manufacturing of Texas, which is a bankruptcy case, 421 Bankruptcy Reporter 251 out of the Western District in 2009. And it says that transfers accounted for in bank statements are not concealed. So the fact that we have the bank statements here, and you can see where all the transfers are, means that they are not concealed. So I think that badge of fraud goes away. Can answer questions about any of the other ones, but I think that's the one I think that is critical here. So essentially, with respect to actual intent fraud, we have possibly two badges of fraud, an insider who retains control of funds, and I don't think under normal business circumstances that is sufficient to make out a case of fraudulent transfer. That's the kind of thing that happens all the time in business where you have an insider, for example, myself, transferring money from my partnership to my PC, which is the partner in the partnership, to myself individually. I'm retaining control of those funds as we go down the line there, but that does not make it a fraudulent transfer.
And Mr. Beverly, were there any items in particular or any testimony or evidence relating to any kind of transfer to or from this probate matter, which ends up the focus, to me, of this temporary order?
No, I don't think there were at the temporary injunction stage. There was really just the evidence that he had gotten the money in the settlement of his father's estate, and that those funds were completely unrelated to any of the claims that Ms. McDowell was making. So beyond that, I don't really think there is much. With respect to the question, which the big legal question, in my opinion, which is, what does other property mean in the context of 24008 A3A? The general rule would regarding freezing up unrelated assets is cited in our brief, the Harper v. Powell case. Very similar facts in which you have claims arising from a divorce, the husband getting funds from inheritance. I see I'm out of time, but I'll finish up real quickly on this point. Funds from an inheritance and temporary injunction freezing those funds. And the court says under those circumstances, it's clearly not appropriate.
And one more question,
sure,
though, before you step down. Apparently, the parties entered into some agreement relative to $115,000.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Is that within this lawsuit or?
It is. That was actually in a separate action, but it is definitely within this lawsuit. The facts are within this lawsuit. What happened there was a separate garnishment action, I believe, in which Mrs. McDowell sought to freeze the funds from the sale of the 1100 Parker Square building. And it was her contention was she was entitled to 20% of those funds. 20% of those funds have been frozen. They are deposited in the registry of the court. So our contention with respect to those funds is they are not at issue here. Those funds have been taken care of. What we're dealing with here are the funds he received from the settlement of his father's estate.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Hernandez.
Thank you. May I please court?
I'm sorry. What's your first name?
Donna Hernandez, represent Mary Patricia McDowell, okay, CMP Family Limited Partnership.
Jay was saying that the order itself is inadequate. Would you start off?
Sure.
Talking about that?
Well, first of all, in response to the earlier question, yes, I did file a motion to modify that order. I've never seen a temporary injunction order that wasn't questioned in some way with regard to the form. I did file a motion for further findings. I filed a motion to modify. That was heard in the judge's chambers just a week or so, maybe 2 weeks ago. The judge did reduce the bond amount, and my argument to the judge was, if you're going to make any changes to the, we need further findings. The judge did not give me further findings at that point in time, so that's where that stands right now. My position would be that if we take form over substance, which in essence rewards bad behavior, but if we do that, then it requires us to go back to the court and reset the case for hearing and rehear the injunction to get those findings, because I think the court clearly found the evidence was there. And along those lines, keep in mind that Mr. McDowell did not attend the injunction hearing. He strategically chose not to attend. Therefore, he didn't put on any evidence, so all the evidence was uncontroverted. And also chose not to discuss the injunction order. So that's where that ended up. Any other questions along that line? Okay. Basically, this is a fraudulent transfer case. It arose out of a 2010 divorce, and there are a lot of complaints about not being enough evidence. The fact is that the evidence before the court at the injunction hearing was that Mr. McDowell did not comply with the terms of the orders from his divorce court. He did not comply with the order from the bankruptcy court. And this plan in the bankruptcy court is a judgment. Once a Chapter 11 plan has been approved by the bankruptcy court, it becomes a judgment. And Mr. McDowell simply sold the building out from under Mrs. McDowell, did not pay CMP the 20% that was due, and there's really no controverting testimony when it comes to that. There's also, you notice they don't even mention the $1.6 million that Mrs. McDowell proved up at the hearing from what I'm going to call divorce damages, things that he did not pay that arose out of his divorce obligations. So there was lots of evidence before the court that Mr. McDowell had, in fact, thumbed his nose at least two previous court orders. That's where we believe the finding comes in, that he did have evidence of prior fraudulent transfers, because the judge heard all this. This court, I know, has said that it will not reverse an order on a temporary injunction unless the court's action was so arbitrary that it exceeded the bounds of reasonable discretion. And obviously, Judge McFarland heard all of this evidence and found that, in fact, the evidence was there. I know there's some arguments that one of the exhibits was not admitted. That is, in fact, true. But there were two other exhibits on summaries of damages that proved up from divorce damages, something like $1.6 million and transfers out of the partnership account for about $1.2 million. Of which Mrs. McDowell would be entitled to 20% of that. So the damages were certainly there. There was, as Mr. Beverly stated, this is a temporary injunction hearing, so we don't have to prove an absolute right to recovery, but a probable right to recovery, and I think all that was there. One of their major issues has to do with the unrelated funds. Do the probate funds, should they be enjoined since they don't have a direct correlation to this case? Well, what we found in the evidence was the $115,000 that we talked about, that was a separate case. We did file a garnishment motion, and that was by agreement that they put those in the registry of the court. There's not, I don't think that has anything to do with this case, simply because we have so many other damages to deal with. The court could see that Mr. McDowell had previously gotten funds and transferred them out of his account. The summary of damages clearly shows that he had taken the funds from the operation of the building and transferred them out into accounts owned and controlled by himself personally and by his current wife, Jamie McDowell. There's just not any question to that. So the next issue is, well, if those funds from the transfer of the, from the sale of the building are gone already, then does the court have the authority to find new funds, basically, to replace those funds that have already been transferred outside of the reach of the court? And I think that's what the court did. And I think that's what the telephone equipment case that I cited speaks to. The Harper case that the appellants rely upon was not a fraudulent transfer case. If you look at the telephone case, they basically said it does not have to be directly related to be subject to an injunction. Let's see. I think it's pretty clear that the sole issue before the court was to preserve the status quo, which is what the court was trying to do by so-called freezing these funds. Now, keep in mind, too, that some of the cases they cite, the court actually required the defendant to interplead or garnish the funds, or they put them in the registry of the court. That didn't happen in this case. In this case, Judge McFarland simply said no further transfers of this money. I cited the testimony where Mr. Yale said, well, what does that mean? So for them to say that this order is not particular enough, they know what that means. Judge McFarland told them what no further transfers means. He wanted them to keep it within an account in his name where he could identify it. So I think that argument fails as well. I think it's very clear also in the telephone case that where a plaintiff does not have a plaintiff does not have an adequate remedy if the defendant is insolvent. And that's what we showed in this case. We showed that all of these funds had been transferred out of the partnership accounts, that Mrs. McDowell testified she had done her research and she couldn't find any assets within the state of Texas or anywhere that were subject to execution. And the only way that she was going to recover on these claims was going to be through these new funds that came in from the probate estate. Keep in mind, too, that the evidence before the court took the court all the way back to the divorce where 6 years ago Mr. McDowell did not pay his obligations under a judgment. His divorce decree is a judgment as well, as the court well knows. Then along came the bankruptcy court. He did not pay his obligations under the bankruptcy court order. So having thumbed his nose at two courts at that point in time, it makes sense that the court would find that there had been fraudulent transfers before and that Mr. McDowell probably would thumb his nose at this court as well.
All right. I'm confused. Where are we? The judge entered the order. It was appealed.
Right.
A motion was filed in the trial court to amend the order. The judge heard the motion while the case was up here, and the judge still hasn't ruled?
He did rule. He heard it in chambers, and basically he signed a modified order that reduced the bond, having found that Mr. McDowell did not have, he had further transferred funds, so there wasn't as much money there as we had thought to begin with. The $625,000 was no longer there, in other words. So he reduced the bond, but he did not make further findings, which was my argument to the judge, was if we're going to change this order, we need to have some further findings.
Well, is that before us, the refusal to make further findings?
No, that just happened a couple of weeks ago.
And the order, the amendment to the order that reduced the amount of the bond, where's that?
It hasn't been brought up, and it probably should have.
So what's before us isn't the live order anymore because it was amended to change the amount of the bond?
That would be my argument, but of course their argument is that all it did was change, and what the judge said is all I'm doing is changing the amount of the bond.
So do we consider your request to amend the order, or is that not before us?
Well, honestly, my thought was that if I could get further findings, that would clearly make this matter moot, or at least would require some re-briefing on the issue because it would change things. The judge only reduced the amount of the bond, so then that, I guess, begs the question of, is that an amendment that would render this order moot, or do we need to start over with our briefing?
What do you want us to do?
I want you to affirm the injunction that's in place.
Is it in place?
Yes. I believe it's in place.
Okay.
The case was set for trial, and it's now been extended till the fall. But I'm asking the court to affirm the injunction that's in place.
Even though you think it needs more particularity?
Well, I would be lying to you if I said I didn't wish that the order had better language in it. Of course, I wish it had better language in it. And yes, I think it needs more particularity. I think it needs to be sent, either affirmed or sent back to the judge for further findings.
Did you ask for that?
I did ask.
You asked us to send it back to the trial court for?
Oh, I apologize. No, I asked the judge for further findings. Let me look at my brief. I don't recall.
But you're not the appellant, so.
I'm sorry?
You're not the appellant, but you didn't.
I did not specify further findings.
Thanks.
Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hernandez. All right, Mr. Beverly, rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Just a couple.
Donna sent y'all an invitation to a party and y'all didn't show up?
Oh, with respect to the temporary injunction hearing?
Yes.
Mr. Yale was there.
Oh, you did go. Okay. Well, that's nice.
With respect to some of the things that Ms. Hernandez has brought up, a breach of contract, there may be damages, but a breach of contract does not equate to a fraudulent transfer. There was evidence in the temporary injunction hearing regarding Ms. McDowell's possible damages from breaches of agreements. We obviously don't agree that with the amount of those damages or that they were incurred. For your purposes here, you would have to assume that there were damages, which is why we're not really contesting anything with respect to a probable right of recovery. But a breach of contract does not equate to a fraudulent transfer. Neither does the failure to follow a court order. Those do not equate to a fraudulent transfer. With respect to the argument regarding insolvency, insolvency is specifically defined under the Texas Business and Commerce Code, and there was no finding in the temporary injunction order that either Safe Parking or Mr. McDowell was insolvent. And in fact, the evidence that was adduced at the temporary injunction hearing would indicate that neither one was insolvent. The evidence was that Safe Parking had intellectual property valued anywhere from several hundred thousand dollars to $1 million. And with respect to Mr. McDowell, the evidence was he just received a $750,000 probate court settlement. So there was no evidence that either one of those entities was insolvent, and the judge correctly did not base the temporary injunction order on insolvency. With respect to the injunctive relief allowed under the Fraudulent Transfer Act, which is back to 24.008A3A, the statute says that injunctive relief is subject to applicable principles of equity and applicable rules of civil procedure. The principles of equity are what come into play here, I believe. Absent any allegation of fraudulent transfer, it is absolutely clear that the relief that the trial court granted would not be allowed. There are numerous cases basically saying that such relief is not allowed under principles of equity. And principles of equity govern all forms of injunctive relief, notwithstanding any statutory grounds. That is from the 183-620 Group Joint Venture v. SPF joint venture case out of the Austin Court in 1989, which is cited in our brief. So when we talk about the principles of equity, there's several cases, including a notable United States Supreme Court case, Grupo Mexicano v. Alliance Bond Fund, which definitely talks about whether equity allows this kind of relief. And opinion by Justice Scalia definitely says there is equitable principles do not allow this type of relief. There are other cases which I think confuse that decision, but clearly the statute must mean something when it says that injunctive relief under the statute is subject to principles of equity. When we look at the long history of case law regarding the ability to freeze unrelated assets, it is clear that that, it's clear that that is not allowed. And so I do not believe that the other property exception in the statute goes that far. With respect to the telephone equipment network case, which Ms. Hernandez talked about, that does uphold a temporary injunction, but the exact language in that case says that they are freezing assets, that the temporary injunction can be upheld with respect to freezing assets affected by the fraudulent transfer. So that is some indication in the telephone equipment case that there must be a relationship, some relationship, between the assets which are being frozen and the fraudulent transfer allegations. And I think every case that deals with 24008A3A has some aspect of that in it. There's no case out there which says, yes, other property means anything that you can get your hands on. And there's no case that says exactly that it is more limited than that. So that is the legal issue that the court will have to grapple with. Thank you for your time.
All right. All right, thank you, Mr. Beverly, and thank you, Ms. Hernandez. We appreciate both of your arguments today, and we appreciate your briefing in this matter. So your case is now submitted, and you both are excused.
Thank you.